From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the years, Andrew Zimmern has been to something like 80 different countries, trying the most bizarre food he can find. Bizarre Foods is the name of his program, one of them anyway. And yes, he's consumed 15 different kinds of rats, and his share of eyeballs and testicles and pretty much every single part of a cow. But if you watch his show, you will realize the program isn't really about the food. It's about the people who cook it and eat it. Zimmern is focused on sharing culture because he says everyone loves a good meal and food is the easiest way to bridge the gaps. Zimmern is coming to Utah this week, which is giving us a chance to talk to him about culture and food and the transformative experience of travel. Andrew Zimmern today, after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here's the idea Andrew Zimmern tried to pitch to network executives years ago. A show that goes to different places and explores the different cultures through their food. Now, that may sound good to you and to me, but it didn't quite do it for the suits. So Zimmern made another run at it. A bald Jewish guy goes around the world eating weird food like bugs and eyeballs. Now, that idea they loved. They bought that idea. And as you all know by now, Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern on the Travel Channel is immensely popular. But the thing is, Zimmern's original pitch, that's still there in the show. And you realize pretty quickly that Bizarre Foods is less about food as people. Zimmern is coming to Utah this week, which is giving us a chance to talk to him. He is a chef, a food writer, a teacher, the author of a number of books, among them The Bizarre Truth, Culinary Misadventures Around the Globe. He's joining us from his office in Minneapolis. And Andrew Zimmern, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to begin with your first interests in food, if that's okay. You've talked about how your father was a legendary eater and traveler. Is that where you started thinking about food? Was with your father?
Yeah, you know, and my mother too. My mother went to Mills College in the 40s with and roomed with Trader Vic Bergeron's daughter. Right. And Trader Vic taught my mother how to cook. So growing up in the 60s in New York City, I think I was the only kid that I knew of whose mother regularly cooked, quote unquote, Polynesian food and made poo-poo platters and the whatnot. But the exposure that we had to food in New York City was not the exposure that we have today. I mean, remember, TV shows were limited to just, you know, two or three that had very limited access. But, you know, people were still ethnically segregated in New York to a large degree. Chinatown was Chinatown. Little Italy was Little Italy. Yeah. There was a second Little Italy in Arthur Avenue in the Bronx where if you walked up and down the street, you could hear Italian being spoken. You could see, you know, pheasants in the butcher cases in season. And that was the world that I grew up in. Yeah. My father was a very successful business executive and help run a very large company. You know, we were not living in the wilds of Oregon where, you know, foraging was something was on anyone's mind. However, he loved food and he loved the experience of food as opposed to just the eating of food. So, you know, summertimes out in Long Island, we foraged. We didn't call it that at the time, yeah. You know, for fresh mussels on the jetties out on the east end of Long Island. We crabbed. We went clam digging. We went fishing. And if my dad surf cast in the late afternoon as the tide was coming up and the sun was setting and caught a big striped bass, it meant that someone had to run back to the house and tell mom. So she would come down to the beach with the supplies so that my dad could set a grate over a big fire and we would roast a whole fish and eat it with my mother's gazpacho and wow. roast potatoes in the jackets in their coals. It sounds very idyllic, but I also got my first lesson on the importance of the disappearing food culture that we had, because we would sit there and while the fish was grilling, we would see the longboats come in. This was still the days out on that part of Long Island where the famous fishing families out there still went out and drew in nets and kept their boat pulled up into the dunes. And every morning at before dawn, they would pull it out and go back to sea. And I remember, you know, my mom looking at me and saying, you know, take a good look at this because this world is fast disappearing. And I started to appreciate the idea that several of the ways in which we approach food were, in fact, could be thought of as what I've nicknamed the last bottle of water in the desert. You know, these were cultural memes that were being bulldozed over by convenience and mass marketing and the commercialization of food. Our food world was much different, but my parents really pointed that out to me in the extreme, much more so than any other kids I was growing up with. And yes, my dad was a larger-than-life character who traveled me around the world 100 times by the time I was 18. So I had a keen appreciation for international cuisine, and he didn't believe in children's menus. He definitely was a when-in-Rome kind of guy. So, you know, when I was 8 years old, at 10:30 at night, I found myself in sleepy little bar restaurants in Les Halles, back when that was a working fishing port in Paris. And, you know, it was an odd mix of dangerously drunk stevedores at the bar drinking pastis and eating simple plates of fish with, you know, culinarians in the know who saw it as a murky, dangerous, attractive place to go for some of the freshest seafood they could. And I sat puzzled in front of a giant plate of bigorneaux, those tiny little blue snails, and a big stainless steel pick that you would pull the little tiny animals out of their shell, cooked in herbs and white wine and served cold. And I fell in love with food right away. So the die was cast. I knew by the time I was 8, 9, 10 years old that I was going to be in the food business. I spent my high school years, when my father said, get a job, working summertimes in restaurants, doing any task that I could, and spent as much time in college while I was completing my studies. I was on the 6-year plan. Right. I kept running away to Europe to cook and to sort of hone my skills. I had natural ability as well. I loved to cook. I understood food. I understood the concept of flavor, and I understood that food didn't have limitations. And so, you know, when I began my formal career in the industry after graduating from college, I had an advanced degree that my parents had provided me.
Did you, I wonder, at what point did you start to see, I mean, you traveled a lot with your father. At what point did you start to see that as a transformative experience? And, you know, at what point did you realize that it wasn't just the food that the experience was about, that it was about the culture and tradition? Did you always sort of get that?
You know, probably by the time I was in my teens. I think it's easy to look in the rearview mirror and see that the growth was there prior to those years. But it's only when you're 13, 14, 15, 16 that you begin to do some comparative thinking in your own brain. Travel is the ultimate transformative experience other than tragedy. Mm. Travel, I believe you are the best version of yourself when you're traveling. You're less risk averse. You're more curious in other people. Yeah. You're eager to learn. I've predicated all of my businesses on the concept of adventure learning based on travel and food. You're the best version of yourself when you're on the road. I like myself on the road way more than I like myself when I'm at home.
I want to back up a bit and ask you about your struggles with addiction, which I know you've talked about. We don't need to spend too much time with this, but For those who don't know, here's how you've described your situation at one point, and this was right near the bottom when you were in New York City. You were a homeless street junkie and an alcoholic. And I wanted to ask you about one particular moment you've discussed before. You've talked about the time when you got some money, you went to a flophouse hotel, you got a room, and you say basically the plan was to drink yourself to death. And you've talked about how that didn't happen. Like, you thought it might, but you didn't end up dying. And it seems like there was a moment when something happened. And I actually wanted you to talk about that moment, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, I had a very low bottom. There wasn't much room left for me to drop. And, you know, I'd gone through all of Dante's circles of hell when it came to my addiction and my alcoholism. I stole a bunch of jewelry from my godmother. I hocked it. Wow. I put a bunch of money down. I rented a room for a week. I bought in a flophouse hotel. I bought a couple cases of cheap vodka in plastic bottles and just was drinking around the clock, hoping that I just wouldn't wake up. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
In fact, the opposite happened. I woke up one morning and for the first time in 20 years, I didn't arise to start the day with that ace bandage of tension around my chest that literally scared the crap out of me so much every morning that I just couldn't face life on life's terms. And I did something, you know, I was the person every apartment that I'd had the previous 5, 6, 7 years, the phone jack was ripped out of the walls. There were probably year old newspapers on the floor. I mean, I was not someone that wanted contact with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And instead of hiding, which I had done my whole life, I reached out and called one of my best friends and asked for help. And within 3 days, I was at an intervention. And I went to Minnesota on a one-way plane ticket. I'm now sober over 25 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've learned by sharing my story with others that people who recover do have that what we call a spiritual awakening sufficient to recover from addiction and alcoholism. And I've spent the last 25 years changing the way I live little by little by little to allow for supporting this new lifestyle of mine. And in fact, it informs absolutely everything that I do.
Yeah.
The creation of Bizarre Foods was specifically built around ideas that I had learned in recovery. I wanted to make a show about patience, tolerance, and understanding in a world that was becoming increasingly divisive. We were battling ourselves, you know, starting 14, 15 years ago in this country. And I sort of, you know, enough was enough.
Yeah.
I didn't understand why we were defining ourselves by our skin color and language and sexuality and religious preferences. I wanted to define ourselves by the things we had in common, civics. And civics seemed to be disappearing. And I thought if I could create a show that explored culture through food and taught people about practicing patience, tolerance, and understanding with each other instead of practicing contempt prior to investigation, if we could stop judging books by their covers, I thought I would have something that was resonant with people, even if it was not on an obvious or conscious level. And so that's how I created, you know, Bizarre Foods. And you're right, as you said at the top, some people still think it's, you know, fat white guy travels around the world and eats bugs. But I see it as something that is a much more useful and educational tool for how we might choose to find a starting place to get along. I believe it's over a plate of food.
You know, it's interesting. When you made that pitch and when the network came back and said, nah, that first thing is not going to work. And then when you kind of simplified it but really didn't change it, was there a point at which, though, during that process, you thought you might have to actually compromise the ideal you had in mind?
Oh, I did compromise. Yeah. I mean, you know, not only did I compromise, but I also sold out to a certain degree. I think anybody on television sacrifices some of their integrity in exchange for a large audience. And I had no problem with that. And I mean, there's advertisers that advertise products on TV networks I've been on that I may not believe in their product.
Yeah.
The minute money is exchanged for something, some form of integrity is lost. But the trade-off was that I had the audience that I was looking for.
Right.
And a very, very smart man was in charge of the network at the time named Pat Young, who's now back with the BBC. And, you know, Pat said to me, look, you're describing a show that's 80% intelligence and 20% entertainment. And we just there's no support for that in the commercial television world. However, you know, let's see if we can't flip flop that around. And if you're willing to make an entertainment program, I'll let you put 20% of intelligence in it. Mm-hmm. And I said yes. And the reason I said yes right away was for one very important reason. I'm an incredible student of culture. And when I choose to research something, I'm kind of an animal about it. And I researched the world of personality-driven television. And it seemed to me that everywhere I looked, from cable to commercial TV on the big networks, if a show was successful, the person responsible for making that show and driving that success, and in this case, it was the talent who was, you know, also involved. I mean, it was, you know, my show is about what I do and what interests me.
Yeah.
That some of the leverage would swing to my side and that I could inject more intelligence every year into the program if I chose to. And that has proven to be the case. I push every year for more and more intelligence to be put into the program. Some years we get more than others. But the show today, when you watch it, the current season especially, is almost a completely different program than the one we started with. Yet the ratings that we had for this last season were our highest since 2011. And I think that the basis on which I predicated the show is the reason that it's been on and flourishing now into its 11th year. I think it resonates with people.
Dude, I wanted you to tell a story that I've heard you talk about. It was like the very first scene of the very first pilot show that you were shooting. This was in Japan.
Sure.
Right? And you have this moment. Like, you have this moment where you can go one way or you can go the other. And I just think this was a really important moment.
I agree. It was I mean, it's one of the four or five defining moments of my life. So I fly to Japan. I arrive at 7 o'clock. I go to the hotel. I go to sleep. I get up the next morning at 6 a.m. I'm driven to the location, and it's scene one, moment one, frame one of what was the first season. The pilot for Bizarre Foods. And, you know, you don't get those opportunities every once in a while. And I knew I was quick-witted and funny, and we were at a place called the Asadachi, which is a getamono bar in Tokyo. And getamono bars are places that serve strange food, strange to Westerners, where Japanese businessmen go to close deals and drink snake wine and eat raw frog and, you know, all kinds of other stuff.
Right.
And Asadachi, it's open all night and through into the morning, and then it closes before lunch before opening again late in the evening. Asadachi in Japanese translates loosely as morning erection because of the high that businessmen would get from closing these big deals in the dawn hours that the restaurant was open. And I was outside, and in those days, we don't do it anymore, but in those days, all TV was built around, especially docu-follow reality TV like mine. There was a stand-up. I'd be walking down the street and say, I'm on such and such street. I'm going to the Asadachi. I'm in search of blankety blank. And then I'd walk in the door. And I remember standing outside the restaurant, and I looked at the chef, and the chef was diminutive in size. He looked a little quirky. He didn't look like me. He was Japanese. I was American. He didn't speak English. There were baskets of live animals hanging above a counter set up where he did his cooking, live turtles, live frogs, insects, things like that. And I had this moment where I was about to speak on camera for the first time, and my first thought was be funny and make some jokes at this chef's and this restaurant's and this culture's expense.
Yeah.
That was the easy way to go. And I had learned – I'd put together a theory in sobriety that the truth is often option number five and that maybe I shouldn't go for option number one. And I did a little mental exercise in my brain to kind of drill down to what my truth was and what the truth of the moment was. And the truth of the moment was that I was going to experience something I wasn't familiar with, but to judge it before experiencing it would be very, very dangerous. And I realized in the blink of an eye that I should just be me.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, you know, why, you know, if this show goes on air and I'm pretending to be a character, I can't sustain that funny character all the time. Certainly that restaurant provided me funny jokes to tell, even the name. But instead, I decided to just, you know, I mean, I think I was funny in the scene, but, you know, just to play it straight that I really was curious. I really was on an adventure. I really did believe in the value system that I was predicating the show on. So the truth for me, which was option five, was just be yourself. And it was one of the smartest decisions I've ever made. I'm a very grateful, respectful person when I'm mindful. And people often comment that the thing they like the most about the show is my respect for other cultures and people. And I came within a blink of an eye of starting out on the wrong foot. And quite frankly, as someone who devours television and digital content in the food and travel space, 99% of the people out there are approaching it completely the wrong way. They're not respectful of other cultures. They're not naturally curious. They're playing a role. They're just a host. I wanted to be in charge of a program that couldn't be done without me. Yeah. In other words, my unique ability was what was being harnessed. And I've used that from an entrepreneurial standpoint in all of my business. I don't want to do things that could be done by someone else. I don't believe in being the best. I believe in being the only.
Yeah.
And being true to yourself, you know, what makes me unique is my humanity and my thoughts and feelings. So if I can put those out there in the commercial space, then no one else can be me. And I think that's why people like Alton Brown and Tony Bourdain are very successful as well. When the cameras are off, they are the exact same person. When the cameras are off me, I am the exact same person.
Yeah.
And you can't say that about everyone else that you see on television in the food and travel space. I think the people who are successful harness that energy and create a unique platform for themselves. And I think that's very important both as a human being, you know, whether you're a postman, a teacher, a doctor, a truck driver, a line cook or whatever, what makes you unique is you. And being true to yourself, I think, is the only way to go through life.
That's Andrew Zimmern. He's host of Travel Channel's series Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. Tonight at 7 at Kingsbury Hall, Zimmern is going to be delivering the keynote lecture in the Natural History Museum's Utah Lecture Series. You can get ticket information and other details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Andrew Zimmern. He's host of the Travel Channel series Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. His job is to tell stories about culture through food, and he insists that people hold off on their contempt of other cultures until they actually investigate. He's coming to Utah. He's going to be here tonight, and he's joining us today on the program. You know, it's interesting. There was this anthropology professor who once referred to you as a colleague. And you said at the time, of course I'm not a colleague. You didn't feel qualified. But he insisted. And you said in your book, you said that was kind of a wake-up call.
Yeah. You know, we had been doing the show about 5 or 6 years, and I was at an academic conclave. And I was being introduced, and he said it was a colleague of mine, and I you know, this is a very famous anthropologist from a giant state-run research institute, you know, university, and I was completely taken aback, and he pointed out to me that there were tenured professors, famous ones, you know, who had not spent as much time in the field exploring the hidden cultures and protected tribes of the world that I had, that, you know, living for 10 days with the Zhentuazi in Botswana or the Lao Tzu in Thailand or the first peoples of Alaska, whether they're, you know, Athabascans or Tlingits or wherever I might be in the part of the world, is something that very few had the opportunity for. And in fact, my experience and the amount of learning that I had done put me in a very unique class of human being. And I was shaken by that. I mean, I felt it put more responsibility on my shoulders. I came to believe in the coming days and weeks that, you know, that responsibility was only given to me because the czars of the universe or czarinas knew that I could handle it. And I dedicated myself. I mean, the importance then, I mean, not only was I experiencing things a lot of people hadn't, but I also realized that in many cases I was the first American, maybe the first white-skinned person, maybe the first of a whole variety of things that a lot of the folks I was spending time with had ever seen in person. And I take that responsibility now very, very seriously. It also really re-engaged me with that, with my work at a time that I was looking perhaps to go on and do other things. It's why I will make bizarre foods until the audience tells me to stop, because I think that the work is very, very important. And you know, tribal systems, we made a Civil War show a couple of months ago that aired, and it created a little bit of controversy. I was with some historical reenactors that were recreating the Battle of Midgeville near Griswoldville in Georgia, I believe. And the reenactors were Confederates because that's who they were back then, their town. And it was a real, I wouldn't call it a crisis of conscience. It didn't approach that level, but I had some real concerns about it. And once I got down there and started talking to the people, it was such a wonderful experience because the reenactors reminded me that none of them were soldiers back then. The people who defended that town, which was at the end of the war, when Sherman was marching from Atlanta to the sea, decimating everything in his wake, they were mothers and kids and shopkeepers and seniors, and they were folks who were just trying to protect their homes from what they knew was a scorched earth policy. And it humanitized them. The issues are never black and white. You know, textbooks may lead us to believe that that war was all about states' rights and slavery. It was about a lot more. And for many people who fought in it, I mean, they didn't own slaves. They were middle class and poor people. They fought for their homes. And I'm not trying to be an apologist for the Confederacy. I'm just pointing out that the situation was a lot more complex, and perhaps we can learn something from that. At the same time, in that same show, we were illuminating what as emancipation became the law of the land, so too we changed our culture forever. But as we all know from reading the headlines every day in the newspapers, we have not come as far as we think we have in many areas regarding race in this country, or classism for that matter. Yeah. And I think the more that we look at these things in an entertainment program like mine, maybe the more we'll allow people to learn, relearn, be introspective, and maybe reinterpret history for themselves.
You know, I've heard you talk about one of the things you access in the places you go are this kind of the spiritual systems of a place. The rituals are really important. And I wanted to ask you about that because it seems like that's the entry point for so much and certainly some of the big questions that you're asking them.
Well, I mean, I'll just use it. The tribal examples are the most obvious, although we do it almost everywhere we go. We do not walk into a place and start firing off the camera. You know, when we were with the Himba in Namibia, I spent days talking and working with them, proving my worth to the tribe through work, through the way they interpreted value in their culture. If you can't contribute to the tribe, you're shunned from the tribe, much in the same way that a herd of wildebeest will take the old alpha male that, you know, is no longer the stud that he once was and push him to the edge of the river so that the crocodiles or the lions or whatever else is eating that day will take that animal and not the young and not the younger alpha males that then take the place of the old wildebeest. You know, work and work ethic and what you can bring to the community instead of what you can take from it seem to be the way to interact with people, whether it was walking into someone's home and they were preparing a family meal and helping out, or being in a tribal situation and spending days working with them to establish some credibility. And the minute you start talking about some of those values and some of those systems, you start to brush up against the, you know, what those communities believe, not in a religious sense, but in a spiritual sense.
Right.
And I had spent my whole life, we were talking earlier about my addiction and recovery. I learned a long time ago that I had for years been a user of people and a taker of things, and that a new life that I was going to lead would have to be predicated on the exact opposite. What was I going to bring to something? What was I going to leave behind? What was I going to give in the spiritual sense freely and without expectation of recompense? And I found it fascinating to be talking with these tribal peoples about that, especially the tribal peoples, because their thinking was, I mean, look, they're at one with their surroundings. Mm-hmm. They live and eat seasonally. They practice, in some cases, the Juntwazi, they don't have personal possessions. Everything is owned by the family group, the tribe. And, you know, I found myself asking these people, you know, are you happy? I mean, you know, are you, you know, what's our place in the universe? You know, some of the big questions that we're often afraid to ask and really afraid to answer. I mean, how many times in our fast-paced American gotta have it now, gotta put up walls culture do we ask someone, how you doing? And someone says, great or fine, when in fact their lives are falling apart. I don't believe necessarily in wearing my life on my shirt sleeve because I don't believe everyone can be trusted with, you know, what I'm thinking and feeling. However, anyone around me at work, a colleague, you know, at a party, I was just at the Food and Wine 10 Best New Chef event, and people ask me what's going on, and I tell them about, you know, my problems at home, my problems at work, my, you know, I mean, I'm a human being. I think we think less about the stuff we're grateful for than we should. I think we spend too much time, at least I do, obsessing about the stuff I want to change or the problems that I'm having. But by sharing that with other people is the only way that I really make progress on it. And I learned that from these tribal peoples. You know, I asked the shaman of the Juntwazi, I asked him, you know, what our purpose was on Earth. And he laughed at me like I was an idiot. And I mean, this is a question man has been asking for as long as there's been man. And I mean, going all the way back to cave paintings. And he looked at me and he laughed and he said, we're just supposed to love each other. And he walked away shaking his head like I was a moron. Yeah. And it really is that simple. I mean, the reason that we're here on Earth is just to love each other. And we've moved so far away from that I think anything that we can do as somebody especially someone like me with a platform to move us back towards that or to inch the needle a little closer to that equilibrium is our civic responsibility.
Andrew Zimmern. He's host of Travel Channel's series Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's going to be at Kingsbury Hall delivering the keynote lecture for the Natural History Museum's Utah Lecture Series. You can get the particulars on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Andrew Zimmern. He's host of the Travel Channel series Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. He's going to be at Kingsbury Hall tonight delivering a keynote lecture for the Natural History Museum. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later on the program. I want to ask you, I know that you've spent some time in your professional life kind of identifying or predicting food trends. You've been pretty good at it, actually. And I want to combine that with your concern about losing touch with culture and ancestry. One thing I noticed, there's this theme in the documentary series, A Chef's Table. And one thing I noticed is, I was watching recently the profile of Alex Atala of Sao Paulo, Brazil, mm-hmm. and Enrique Olvera in Mexico. And it's like both of them, and I think this is true of a lot of chefs maybe, and I wanted to get your sense of this. They have their own sense of what they want to do. They become good chefs in a certain form. But when they really come into their own talent is when they return to their own ancestry. And I wondered if you think there was something to that.
I don't think there's something to that. I think there's everything to that.
Yeah.
And let me approach that answer two ways. First, as a chef, and then as a sentient being that's representative of culture with a big platform.
Yeah.
As a chef, and I'll just pick America. The first thing you do is you learn Western cookery. You know, you learn how to butcher a chicken the way the French and Italian, the way the Europeans did it.
Right.
Right. Now that's. That may be obvious to people, but think about it. Chinese, you know, Koreans, Pacific Islanders butcher chickens completely differently than we do, and cook them differently and eat them differently. But, you know, it's just from its very basic, we learn one way of doing things. Gaston Acurio, who has done the same thing that Enrique Olvera did, the same thing that Alex Atala did, like many great chefs. Gaston Acurio is probably the most obvious example of it. I when I did my Lima show, we discussed this point at great length. He opened Astrid E. Gaston 25 years ago with his wife, and he basically cooked fancy French food in year one. And when he looked at his menus year by year by year, he noticed that by year 10, he was using traditional Limeño techniques but using European ingredients. And then – about halfway through the restaurant's lifespan, he closed and moved it to a different location where he has a huge food center. He started exploring the world of local ingredients, which in Peru are some of the most abundant in the world, just like in Mexico and just like in Brazil, another two countries with abundant ingredients, hidden systems of ingredients, hidden foods, lots of different techniques and ingredients in different regions of those countries. And what Acurio wound up with at year 25 was cooking guinea pig, cuy, as it's known down there, in the traditional style. And he couldn't have been more tribal in a sense if he tried. And he was serving it to people who were, you know, throwing down whatever, $250 for the tasting menu, right?
Right, right.
Enrique Olvera at Pujol famously has a course that's just sauce on a plate that you eat with a tortilla.
Right.
But that sauce is a mole that's been simmering on the stove for 90 days, sometimes longer.
Yeah.
They never turn the stove off. They just keep adding things to it. There is nothing more rustic, as it's called in food magazines, but also more peasant, more working class, more humble, more culturally relevant bridging today with 1,000 years ago than making a stack of fresh tortillas mm-hmm. and a sturdy sauce and letting people mop it up with those tortillas. That's the way people have eaten. Those are the foods born of necessity.
Yeah.
So there is a cultural touchstone that comes with experience and success where you can abandon all the ways that people expect you to cook and start to cook the way you feel you should cook. And I think as culinarians, especially ones that come into success and maturity, the one thing that they all have in common, whether they're Brazilian, Mexican, Peruvian, German, Australian, Japanese, Chinese, is that you get to a certain point in your career and you go all the way back to your roots and you're able to present and cook in a very simple way with a message. And you cannot do that when you're hiding behind another country's tradition or your own desire to not be who you are. The brilliance of Adela, the brilliance of Olvera, the brilliance of Acurio and chefs like that is that they are willing to tell their own truth and be who they are and put that onto a plate. And I'm very aware of this because, you know, as we just discussed a short time ago, I did the same thing not with my food but with the media that I produce and create, the content that I make. And I think that's something that maturity brings. And some people will say, oh, yeah, well, it's easy for Olvera to put sauce on a plate when he has a 3-month waiting list for meals at Pujol. And, you know, that's fair. If you're successful, you can certainly take risks. But imagine the pressure taking that kind of risk that could, you know, I don't want to say fold an empire, but if people didn't respond to it and then the message that's out there in the world is, oh, Pujol isn't what it used to be. Instead, it elevated Pujol mm-hmm. and a restaurant that is consistently in the top 50 in the world, then opened a branch in New York that is now another top 50 restaurant in the world with a chef at the helm who's a woman, God forbid, and has actually created more benefit for his messaging, his company, you know, his team, I mean, every possible way, and contributes more to the culture and the history of food. What those chefs do is a spiritual practice that I have nicknamed investing in the loss. I learned it from one of my gurus. You know, if you're not willing to take risks, not a lot can be gained.
Yeah.
And sometimes to go left, you need to invest in first going right. And I think that that's something that, you know, Adela has done, that all those chefs that you mentioned have done. And I think all people in that space, I think, have that in common. And I think I resonate with it as a chef because I did that at a point in – I mean, when I'm cooking now, I cook food inspired by the road. It's right. The only thing I know how to do anymore because it's the only thing that interests me or excites me. Every dish that I put on a plate has to tell a story, and it has to be an important story, and it has to feel like it's me, and it has to be something that's understood. And I learned that on the road. You know, I've been in jungle markets in Nicaragua where, you know, there's been a stew that's just made of blood and guts and spices and chilies, and poaching in it are iguana eggs. And they spoon it out for me and they give it to me with their sort of coarse version of a tortilla or perhaps some sort of floury dumpling that's cooked in the sauce at the last minute. And if you look at that bowl of soup or stew for long enough, you can tell the story of those people in that bowl. Mm. And those are the stories, the only ones that I'm interested in putting on a plate anymore.
Let me ask you this finally. It's interesting, you know, when your mother, when you were young, was talking to you about her concern for tradition and culture in food going away? I mean, you've been thinking about this for a long time.
And 50 years.
Yeah, so you would think that you would be cynical about this, but you've said that you're kind of bullish, at least on young people, and that we're at this pivotal swing point. Talk about how you're thinking about what's going to happen.
Well, I look back at social justice movements of the past. Two that impact, I'll just pick seatbelts and cigarettes.
Right.
It took 25 years for us to get people to wear seatbelts. No one drives without wearing a seatbelt anymore, essentially.
Right.
It took us 25, 30 years to get warnings on cigarette labels, and cigarette sales have been falling ever since. And, you know, kids don't think smoking's cool anymore. That was a 25-year social justice movement sufficient to change the way we look at something. Many people are confused by the state of our food system, our eating world, our culinary culture here in America. And the reason they're confused by it and they get a lot of conflicting messages is that we're midway in that 25-year social justice movement sufficient to recover from the dangerous precipice to which we've pushed our food lives. And both from a health and wellness standpoint, like, you know, we should – I mean, if I could wave a magic wand, I'd just get rid of sugar right away.
Yeah.
You know, it's addictive. It's awful for you. It's maybe the most powerful drug in the world. 25% of Americans are food insecure. We're wasting 40% of our food. I mean, we're just in a hurry. We're not eating sustainably. We're destroying our planet. We're maltreating animals. I mean, you just go on and on and on. But it's a confusing place because so many people see the hope and the interest and the concern, and it's out there and being talked about. We're talking about it right now.
Yeah.
That was not the case 15 years ago. And the reason it's confusing for people is that I look at social justice movements like ancient voyages across oceans. Right now, we are in the middle of the ocean. We are guiding ourselves only by the stars, and we can't see land behind us, and we can't see land in front of us. But I'm bullish because I know I trust the stars, and I trust the captains of our boat, and we are moving in the right direction in this country from a food standpoint. We are now at the point where our leadership in the food movement in this country, and I'm very proud to be included in that group, understand the necessity for legislation on these issues, for lawmaking, much in the same way like it was for seatbelts and cigarettes.
Yeah.
If we don't give the ideas around what we put into our bodies every day, if we don't give the wellness of food the credit it deserves and the legal backing behind it, we'll be lost. But I'm also very, very bullish on that. I think it is going to happen. I'm hoping that it does not take a tragedy on a grand scale to have us reimagine our food system. And the tragedy I'm talking about, I mean, you know, the Cavendish banana is going the way of the horse and buggy, right, because of a blight associated with it. We are continuously at risk with losing the Florida orange crop to a bunch of different blights that botanists down there are very, very concerned about. We're overfishing species to the point of extinction from our oceans. I'm hoping it doesn't take a tragedy like one of those coming to fulfillment to grab everyone's attention, but it might. But I do think that people should remember that our food world 25 years from now will look completely different. And I'll leave you with this thought. Man has existed, walked around on planet Earth for a long, long, long time. And relative to that long, long, long time, we have only been eating for pleasure for a very short, short, short time. In the same way that we could be selling robotic cars everywhere today. The technology is there. It's just that the culture isn't ready for it, right?
Yeah.
People aren't ready to get into a car and not put their hands on the wheel and be masters of their own destiny from a psychological standpoint, most importantly. And I think the same thing with taking food not for pleasure, which I do believe is something that will be done in 15, 20 years. You know, Soylent is just one of many products out there that is a nutritional food substitute that I do not believe we should be taking it three times a day for meals. I think there are many, 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 many benefits to actually eating and breaking bread with each other. But just as we go vegetarian once a week or maybe vegetarian before dinner time, maybe just as we eat smaller portions of meat, more grains and legumes, eat fish only small ones with their heads on it, and let the larger pelagic species roam free, just as we're willing to make those changes, would we, out of the 21 quote-unquote meals we take a week, would we substitute one or two with something that has no taste or artistic value or any cultural relativity? Would we do that with 10% of what we put into our body two meals a week? I think the answer is yes. I think that that's the kind of reset we need. I think we've taken too much from this planet already. I think it's time to start giving back. And the best way to give back might be to change the way we think of food as much as actually what we're eating. Mm.
It's Andrew Zimmern, chef, food writer, and teacher, host of Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods with Andrew Zimmern. Tonight, he's delivering the keynote lecture for the Natural History Museum's Utah Lecture Series at Kingsbury Hall. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Adrian Moranville, produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.